Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Intuitive Transformation Radio, psychic and wellness talk radio and so much more, hosted by Matthew Engel, the intuitive counselor and psychic. This program was created in love to offer insights and perspectives as you transform your way through your life's journey. We're not here to give advice, only you are responsible for your choices. For additional information about this program, please visit intuitivetransformationradio.com. If you're listening live and would like to call in with a question, the number is 646-378-1415. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Radio. Today is Wednesday, June 1st, 2016. It's always a pleasure to be back on the air. Joy is not with us today, but I am here live on the air. And we have an interesting topic today, as always. I've always believed that taking care of the earth is not just a practical thing to do, but it's also very spiritual. And coming from the ancient proverb, the earth was not given to you by your parents, it was loaned to you by your children. I think that's something that we all need to keep in mind. And today I'm going to be playing a pre-recorded interview with an old friend of mine who has dedicated time in her retirement to being involved with a nonprofit organization in her small Massachusetts town that is focused on creating sustainable practices and reducing dependency on fossil fuels. I'll be playing a pre-recorded interview, and I'll be talking a little bit about this person momentarily. A few quick announcements before I proceed. If you were interested in the Introduction to Psychic Skills for Daily Living class on June 19th in San Francisco, that class is now full. It is sold out. A few people have expressed interest since the class was full, and if you happen to be one of them, shoot me a private message after the show, because I am creating a wait list, and if there's enough of an overflow list, I may in fact add an additional class later this summer. Otherwise, the next class will be in the fall, and of course, as always, I will announce that on the air and post information in my newsletters, which of course you can sign up for at MatthewEngel.com. Let's see. Becca King is a retired psychotherapist, having worked in private practice and public community mental health agencies for 30 years. She has focused on transferring her prior work in addictions recovery to her current work with Greening Greenfield, a local citizens' energy nonprofit organization which addresses the need to get off fossil fuels, reducing carbon emissions, and changing our lifestyle to a healthier one, more awakened and related to our natural environment, much like a 12-step process. She co-chaired the town's successful 10% Challenge campaign, helping Greenfield, Massachusetts, to become the first town in Massachusetts to receive the Green Community designation. She has a strong commitment to building community along the principles of sustainable living, justice, and interfaith peacemaking, and is a member of the Franklin County Interfaith Council. So I'll be introducing Becca momentarily, and I hope that you'll enjoy the show.
Welcome, Rebecca. It's a pleasure to have you on the air. I'm so excited to talk about Greening Greenfield.
Oh, it's a delight for me to be in contact with your neighborhood from my neighborhood, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, tell us a little bit about the history of Greening Greenfield. Greenfield, Massachusetts, yeah. It's a small town, western Massachusetts, looks like about 18,000 people from their website.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
How did all of this come to be, and how long has it been going on?
Okay, well, I'm happy to give you as much of the background as I can. It started as an energy committee, just a volunteer, a bunch of people came together, a bunch of friends really, came together in around 2005 and were talking about, you know, the whole issue of fossil fuels and, you know, the release of the carbon dioxide into the ozone layer and, I mean, into the atmosphere. And just people were showing their concern. And so they said, well, let's form a group and meet on a regular basis and see where this wants to go. And so basically, a couple of years later, we organized ourselves in a real sort of formal. We said, okay, we are more than a group. We are going to call ourselves the Green and Greenfield Campaign and Committee. And in the very first phase of it, which was, you know, really the first year or so, we really just we wanted to research how we could actually, you know, raise money so that we could do something. We could have a flyer. We could have, you know, a logo and create a brochure and that kind of stuff. So it just happened that there was a matching grant from the Massachusetts Technology Collaborative, and one of the women on our committee was very savvy about grant writing, and she happened to just look around and saw this one, and it basically meant that if Greenfield residents invested in wind power, or green electricity, really it was, that they would match every donation and send that match to the town. In other words, we weren't raising it for ourselves, but we were raising it so that the town could have this money to then do what we wanted to do, was a town-wide energy audit. We wanted to find out what we were using as a town and then set some goals for it. So that was our phase two that we kicked off with an ice cream social at a local ice cream joint. And, you know, we thanked many people who invested in this green electricity, and by that time we had $19,000 after just a year of this. We put on a big campaign and
wow.
went door to door and made flyers. And so with that money, we were able to do this audit. And that meant hiring somebody to do data entry on all kinds of, you know, the electrical companies, the gas companies, the oil companies, and even the wood-burning stove companies. You know, what were people doing in the area? And we actually even got a documentary film videographer to make a little short video that was posted on our cable TV station about, you know, about what this was emerging into. Then we joined a program called ICLEI. It's a Cities for Climate Protection program, which I think is a national organization. And we did our.
I'm sorry. Would you say that name again? Is that an acronym?
It is an acronym, and it doesn't stand for anything. ICLEI, ICLEI, and
okay.
It does stand. Obviously, it stands for something, but nobody ever knows what it is. It's basically Cities for Climate Protection, which is
okay.
Great. Yeah. So anyway, we set after we had done our audit, and we set two goals out of the audit, which was to keep 100% of our energy dollars in the region as much as we could and to cut climate change emissions by 80% by 2050. And we had the local mayor who signed on for this goal for the town. And so really what Greening – I have to back up a little bit and just say one of the things that Greening Greenfield has done, and really it's all we've done, is to influence the town in making policies that are sustainable and green, basically, in any ways we can, and that includes every aspect of the town. We get involved in the schools, we get involved in the DPW, the Department of Public Works, you know, development, buildings, all kinds of things. We just all we're doing is research and telling them what we could be doing. So anyway, we joined
Becca,
this.
What are some of the specific tasks that people do to create more sustainable living or eco-friendly living in Greenfield within the realm of housing or construction or schools or local government and that kind of stuff?
Okay, so in terms of housing, in terms of individual housing, we started there. We started with a campaign called the 10% Challenge, which was asking, inviting the town to reduce their energies 10% by 2010. This was back in 2009. And then by the end of 2010, we wanted to be able to have them reduce their energy use by 10%. So we had very simple things that they could do, which had to do with the clear, you know, the obvious things like, changing light bulbs, wearing a sweater, turning a thermostat down. We live in New England, so it's cold here in most of the mm-hmm. year, except for 3 months in the summer. And that would affect, of course, air conditioning as well in the summer. But just we had a pledge form that we had people sign, and there were all kinds of no-cost and low-cost things that they could easily do. And then we had a little marketing study done by our local community college marketing students, and they basically said the main message for our town, because we're a county seat in the poorest county in Massachusetts, so we don't have a lot of money here, and people are mostly motivated by money. They're not motivated by caring terribly much about the environment.
Yeah.
And so if they could save money, that was where we were headed. So we showed them ways that they could reduce their electric bills, their gas bills, you know, basically that. And the ways had to do with very common stuff. I mean, very ordinary stuff that by now it seems so strange. I mean, 7 years later, it's now a part of our culture. We don't even I can hardly remember what we did, which is mm-hmm. sort of crazy. But we had a lawn sign campaign so that if people signed the pledge, they could put a lawn sign out or in their window if they lived in an apartment that said, 10% challenge and we're doing it and we've joined it. We've got 1,800 homes in the town. There are 18,000 residents, but we got 1,800 homes to sign on to this pledge. And then we went to all the businesses in town, and I think we had something like 59 businesses that also signed the pledge, and they had their employees signing up for the pledge for their homes as well. So we had workshops. We held a series of workshops to show people how they could tighten what they call the envelope of their house, you know, the insulation, window, you know, leaks, how to find their leaks. We have a organization at the state level called Mass Save, and they would send people around to people's homes if they called the number and do an audit on their home, on the energy efficiency of their home. And so, you know, people then could find out what they could do and how they could pay for it. We found a couple of banks in town that would give zero interest loans if it was a big job.
No kidding.
Yep. And all of this has to do with knowing what the state and the government are willing to pay for. So I would say to your listeners in this show, you know, you need someone who is willing to do that kind of background checking and research, because we were very lucky to have a person who just loves that kind of stuff. And most of us, ordinary folks, you know, who are just working a job and coming home at night, don't necessarily know people in those areas. So if there's anybody if you know anybody like that, that's a great boon. If you don't, it's still there are programs that you can just go to Google and mm-hmm. say how do we save money in California, you know, or in San
right.
Francisco. There's probably
right.
stuff that the city is doing. There's probably stuff the state is doing. So anyway, so we used our local cable TV station to film our workshops, and so they would play nonstop. You know, I mean, they would play after the workshop was over. And we outreached to faith communities by sponsoring a training for the churches and synagogues called Savings Through Energy Management. It was called STEM, led by a Connecticut team, actually, that we had found out about online. So, you know, we just, they came up and they did a training, an 8-session training for churches to get on board, because we wanted to say, look, this is a moral issue as well as a financial issue.
Absolutely.
For the planet and for us. And gosh, I don't know. Do you need something more specific than that?
No, that's very specific. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really, what impresses me, there are so many things that impress me about this, but part mm-hmm. of, you know, I'm actually taking very copious notes as you were talking. And, you know, you reached out. First of all, you were able to get free resources by using a college marketing students to work on a project. You're
right.
Reaching people in churches and synagogues. You're reaching people
mm-hmm.
in local government. You're finding out
mm-hmm.
what's happening on a state level.
You're
also doing some projects with kids, yes, or in the schools?
Yes. Oh, and one of the things that we've created, I happen to have a friend whose business went out of business. He had a women's sport, a gym, and it went out of business. And one of the things that he was getting rid of was a roulette wheel, you know, that spins and has
uh-huh.
tick, tick, tick. Anyway,
oh,
so I convinced him to donate the roulette wheel to us. And so we created a game that we would schlep around to fairs and just on the street corner by the post office. And each little tick, each little nail that sticks out from the roulette wheel had a question or a number attached to it. And each number had a question about the environment that people who would stop by and would play a game with them, saying, what if these three things is a true one, you know? Or how many tons of waste do you think Greenfield gets rid of every year, and how many would we save if we composted? It's, you know, those kinds of questions. What is the best way? What are three ways that you can reduce your energy bill? And so we'd get kids involved in that, and if they got the question right, we'd give them candy. Or if they were adults, we got a compact fluorescent light bulb by huge amounts from our local electric company, because they were getting advertising for it. So, you know, we had our own buttons made up, you know, little buttons, political buttons, but it was Green and Greenfield buttons. So, you know, we'd reward people for being smart. And it was interesting, because over the years that we did that, maybe two or three years, we found that people no longer were stumped. I mean, they all knew the answers to every question, which showed us that we had at least done something in educating the public. So that was really fun. Then we started to work with a superintendent of schools on wanting to be able to, first of all, check out the dining room, the cafeteria, what kind of food were they serving. It was a lot of it was just junk. And the person who was in charge of the kitchen at that time has since been let go. But at that time, he was resistant to changing anything. I mean, he just thought, well, you know, the kids won't eat apples if we put them out. They'll only eat candy bars, you know. I mean, it was just that bad.
Mm-hmm.
So we worked a lot with the superintendent and the school principals. We have five schools in town and the high school, including the high school. To try to see, is there any way that we can get into the school? And, of course, they were all out straight with statewide testing, and they just thought, oh, no, we just don't have time in the curriculum in the day to put any other
right.
curriculum in than what we already have. And this is what we're already doing. And we said, okay. So we kind of backed off from that and said, what we'll do is we'll create an event for students for once a year. It's called the Science and Sustainability Expo. And we held it at the local community college so that kids from the whole region could come with two possibilities of participating. One was creating a wind turbine, a little miniature wind turbine, so they could study that and understand how it works with a fan. It was amazing what they created. And the other one was a dollhouse competition where kids would create, build or use a dollhouse and then decorate it bring art forms to it to make it the greenest possible idea of what would a greenhouse look like, a zero net energy house. So
mm-hmm.
that was fun, and there were prizes and awards and a lot of publicity for that. And then finally, we have a new superintendent who happens to be very keen on going green and being sustainable in the school district. And
mm-hmm.
so we are now in a process of applying for what is a national, a federal program in the Department of Education called Green Ribbon Schools. And so we're in the process of doing that now. But in the meantime, we've also influenced the fifth grade. There's a piece of the fifth grade curriculum that studies the water cycle. So we have sort of inserted things like rain gardens and where does the water go, and it goes into the local Connecticut River, and so what, you know, how do you, what kind of effluent is that, and how do you treat water at a water treatment plant, and the kids actually go over and visit the water treatment plant, and you know, they've done a lot. They've actually done an art project in that, Greg, where they're designing painted storm drains so that it will bring people's attention to the storm drains in town so that they can now educate people, well, where does our water go? Where does it come from and where does it go? So stuff like that we're doing in the schools. And it's exciting. It's slow going, though. It's because schools are so taxed with everything they're supposed to be doing, and then, you know, how much extra can they take on. So we're working, we have maybe four teachers in our whole school system that are absolutely rabid about this subject. So they are our allies, and they are the ones who are getting a lot of this stuff into the different schools. We also have, in terms of our four elementary schools, the former superintendent had them all called Discovery Schools. I don't know if this is a national program or a state program, but each school has like a major, like a particular personality. One is focuses on architecture and history. Another one focuses on science and sustainability. And another one's on the arts. You know, it's that kind of thing. And what that means is that Friday afternoons they get to do something special in that particular topic, in that particular subject. So it depends on which school you go to, what topic you get. But the one that is focused on science and sustainability, we have done some programs for them as well, after school programs. And, you know, so there's lots of different ways that people can do this. You know, it just depends on who you... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it sounds like you really found a way to work with the public schools. I mean, as you know, I worked in public schools for a long time. I was a social worker and a mental health consultant. So, I mean, I come from a family of public school educators and special educators. I mean, I get it. Schools, and today they're far more. They really are taxed. So, grafting onto a school system is really, really tough. I mean, I did that. I don't know, 16 years ago, grafting a mental health program onto a large public high school, as you know. And that was a huge undertaking because they don't have the time.
How
but
long
these
did
issues
that take
are
in that?
Important. That took it was gradual. I would say by year four it was the program was very well up and running with four full time licensed clinical social workers who were licensed therapists on staff, on the teacher contract. I mean, there were variables in the mix. There were a few people that retired, so there was money that opened up, and I think the stars were aligned. But we also had a new administrator who was very proactive in mental health. But the school system had been resistant to it for 30 years, despite all of the research on how mental health supports reduces costs in all other kinds of ways for children in schools. But anyway, I don't want to digress too much on that. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
The reason I asked how long it took is it's taken us 10 years to really get the school as a whole district with a superintendent behind it. It's taken us that long. So what I can say is it's not an overnight thing unless you happen to really, you know everybody. And the other thing about Green and Greenfield is that we're all pretty much the people who are the most active are retired. So it's not like we're not parents with young kids, you know. Yeah. And so, you know, if we know people in town who have kids, that works out well. But, you know, a lot of other towns around us, like Williamstown, Massachusetts, they have their energy committee is all young parents with kids. So they whisked their stuff through the school system. In fact, the kids are initiating policies for the town that the town fathers are voting on. So, you know, we just had to do what we could do.
Of course.
And with our own people, you know, with the limitations. So.
Well, part of what I heard, though, is in working with some of the curriculum challenges, because they are taxed in terms of largely in the public schools these days, they're teaching for the test with standardized testing. And I know that's a huge debate among educators. The classes are larger than they've ever been in many school systems, and the curriculum standards keep getting higher and higher, and standardized testing is getting more complicated.
I know.
And all of that. But what I hear, you created events that happen once a year. And certainly most public schools, if not all, the kids do have field trips.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if they're working into the curriculum, make it a field trip to bring the fourth graders or the fifth graders or the third graders or the eighth graders, whomever, this event where they're doing all these demonstrations and it's hands-on and they get to see it. They're really making that into a hands-on, you know, experience that kids can relate to because they're seeing it in action. And I love how you use the roulette table or the roulette game to the Q&A and the candy and going to the water treatment plants and all of that kind of stuff, the Connecticut River. These are all really practical ways that kids can see this stuff and interact with it in real time rather than just reading it about it in a textbook. So I don't know. I mean, it feels to me as though this stuff could very well be grafted onto or perhaps part of some of the science curriculum that already exists. And if it's done as a field trip day, then therefore it doesn't have to draw from the rest of the curriculum that teachers are trying to, you know, meet the standards of over the course of the rest of the school year.
Yeah. Well, field trips, I mean, and that has to do with what kind of a budget does the school have for field trips. Our town is kind of a walking town downtown, and they will let the kids walk to some place, but like the water treatment plant actually is fairly walkable for one of the elementary schools, but not from the others. So they were the ones that got to go to the water treatment plant, you know. And but what I want to say is also we had another project fairly early on in our development that we call the Green Hero of the Month, and we worked very hard at creating a wonderful relationship with our local newspaper. It's a daily, small but nevertheless daily newspaper, and each month we would have a half page. A feature article on someone in the community that did something to save energy. And I mean, some of the time we had kids being the heroes because we had one teenage girl who was one of five sisters. And their father actually had taken one of our workshops, and he had a Prius, he had solar on his roof, he had MassSafe come and do all the insulation over again. But the one thing he couldn't get was his five daughters to take shorter showers. And they were like in there for 20 minutes each, you know, or half an hour. Uh-huh. And they would just stay in the shower with the long blonde hair and, you know, whatever. So we got one of the daughters actually became a hero because she caught on. She said, okay, I'm going to do a five-minute shower and see if I can get clean in 5 minutes. Well, of course, she did it in like 2 minutes and then had – 3 more minutes to linger, you know. But so we just thought it was so cute that she that she made this huge sacrifice and showed up all her sisters, so we made her a green hero. And then another young girl rode her bike to school from, you know, maybe 3 miles away. It wasn't huge, but it was, you know, for her, she rode her bike to school, and in this climate sometimes that's a sacrifice. So, you know, getting the kids to realize that to make a life change, to make a behavior change, it's not unlike having to do a 12-step program. Mm. Because because we're all addicted to having life be just the way it is, and with a huge amount of wonderful stuff, and we can go out and get stuff, and we have more stuff than we need, and that anybody needs. But nevertheless, we think we need it because we're told that we need it by the advertising community, and you know, it's the way it is out there for the kids today. So, So that was another thing that sort of brought publicity to people's behavior change, and I actually ended up writing a 12-step article for our newspaper on because I was a retired therapist myself and worked a lot with people with addictions, and so I said, okay, well, my new client is my town, and the addiction is to the use of excess energy, and so that's what motivated me to get involved in this. Like, I could really just see it and feel it in my body, you know. I just I felt pain for the planet, you know, just it was just being used and used and abused, and there was no end in sight, and people were in so much denial, as is the case in addiction, that I thought, okay, how do you deal with denial? You know, well, one step at a time. The first step is you show up. You show up in one small way to say, okay, I've changed all the light bulbs in my house, or I'm taking a 5-minute shower, or, you know, I'm not drying my clothes in the dryer, I'm hanging them out. Of course, a lot of people can't do that in the city, but, you know, I have a clothes, a wooden clothes folding up thingy. I don't know if you know what you say. You know, clothes.
Yeah, right.
So I hang my clothes on the wooden thing, and it takes a day to dry. It's not instant. Uh-huh. It takes a day to dry them, but then they're dry, and they're not as fluffy as they are in the dryer. But, you know, that's a small sacrifice to make, to save a few bucks on electricity and to not have so much energy being used for stuff that really isn't necessary, you know. So we're having to change what we think is necessary. And we absolutely need, and I feel like that is a spiritual issue for all of us in this country.
Absolutely.
Identifying the difference between a need and a want. You know, I want my towels to be fluffy, but I don't need them to be fluffy. You know? I mean, really.
Okay.
This doesn't sound at that sort of level.
Right.
You know, I will try to drive my car at the speed limit. And see what happens. See if I save anything on that. And a lot of it's just learning from your own experience. That's really what people learn, you know.
You know, part of what I'm thinking about is people don't even necessarily have to take every single possible step. Even if you just take one or two steps, like walk to do one errand, you know, just start with something. You know, I'm thinking even along the lines of an addiction model. Well, what do people do? They say, okay, I'm going to be sober today, or with this at this event, I'm not going to have a drink, or that kind of a thing. You know, just if it starts with one item, and then maybe another day it's another item. Maybe it's just doing one item a day, or 3 or 4 items per week, just to kind of reduce something. Then something is anything. And, you know, look, let's face it. If everybody reduced their energy consumption by 10%, you're talking, I mean, I don't know how many billions and billions of gallons of oil that would be, but it would be a lot.
Well, and it's more than just, see, we tend to think of energy as oil, gas, and electricity, but it's also our local food. One of the questions on our roulette wheel was, how far does a carrot have to travel to get to your table?
Right.
You know, and they had to guess, and then we had an answer to that. You know, if it's from Japan or, you know, South America, imported, then, you know, it's X number of miles. And if it's from your backyard, it doesn't have very far to go at all. So how about growing something in your backyard? And, you know, so it's the indirect savings of energy, your clothing, your food, what you buy for birthday presents for your kids. Is it plastic? Is it, you know, and plastic comes from oil. So, you know, beginning to connect the dots about our entire national lifestyle and when we go shopping for something, where is it made? How is it made? What are the materials that are used? And how are they gathered from the earth? Because everything comes from the earth, our mother, you know, our Gaia.
Sure.
And so we begin to educate people about those connecting of those dots. And so now in Greenfield, you know, we really have we also live in the agricultural belt of Massachusetts. So we have a lot of local small farms. They're not big. They're not agribusiness. They're just small mom-and-pop farms. But we have farmers markets, and we have a huge culture now that's just, you know, we can't get enough farmers markets. We have so many of them. In fact, I think we have 3 in Greenfield, different days of the week.
Amazing.
So, you know, that just something like that. And then our clothing, you know, people are beginning to think more about clothing and accessories and what we buy, you know, just, I don't know, where things are made. So it's we're not perfect. We have a lot that we're not doing. But, you know, we're moving slowly. It's a slow process. And here we are trying to shoot for 80% reduction of everything by 2050. And, here it is already 2016, and, you know, it's kicking off. Now we're going for 25% by 25.
Okay.
Statewide, okay. Massachusetts is going for 25% by 25. But, you know, that's not going to get very far towards 2050. So, you know, it depends on whether you believe that we don't have a lot of time in terms of the, you know, do you know, you know, the Inconvenient Truth? Did you see Al Gore's movie?
Sure, of course,
That's a wonderful educational thing, and it's still relevant, even though it's about 4 or 5 years old. Just showing about the ice melting and the effect of carbon dioxide and methane on polar ice caps,
right,
and how that's affecting everything, and the rise of the seas. And there are places like in the Seychelles Islands where they're having to plan, you know, how are they going to get out of there when the seas rise another inch or two? So,
right.
You know,
I remember a number of years ago you had a project with the town where you were marking the telephone posts and the street signs and all of that, showing
after
the
flood.
The,
yeah, we had a
after
flood,
floods
after
with water rising.
Yep.
Talk a little bit about what that was about.
Well, it was just, we had a Hurricane Irene in 2011. Was it 2010 or 2011? It was really one of the biggest that we've had in the century. And, you know, homes were wiped out, streets were wiped, bridges. Oh, yeah. I mean, they're still repairing from that 5 years
right.
later. And so people marked their, you know, the where on their house the water rose to, and telephone poles, you know, where the water rose to. And it's just astounding to see now
right.
how high it got. And it wasn't for very long. It was for only a couple of days that it was that high, because it ebbed, as all things
right.
do eventually. But
right.
It tells a story. We Green and Greenfield didn't do that. People just spontaneously did it.
Along the lines of water rising, there's another
mm-hmm.
documentary film. Perhaps you saw it. Came out in 2014. It's called Chasing Ice.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
that is really – it's available on Netflix. When
mm-hmm.
I watched it a year or two ago, I think it was only available on DVD through Netflix. I don't think it was – you could download it, but maybe
right.
that's changed.
Yeah.
It was an award-winning documentary film with a photographer who took photos over a series of years in the Arctic, and literally monitoring, I mean, videos and photos and footage of the glaciers literally melting. I mean, massive,
yeah.
massive
yep.
chunks
yep.
of ice just falling into the ocean, and monitoring the jet streams as it's flowing southward. So it's, of course, melting. And you
mm-hmm.
could visually see the difference in the amount of ice that was on the glacial mountains over a series of years. I mean, if ever there was a film that to me brought made it possible to witness the prospect of oceans rising, that was it. It was really a phenomenal
right,
film. I
right,
highly recommend
yep.
it to listeners.
Great.
This is something that's very real, and it is something that's very spiritual. I believe that we are here to preserve, to do what we can to preserve this planet that is our source of physical life anyway.
Yeah.
I also love that, you know, you mentioned that in Green and Greenfield, many of the people who were most actively involved or who created the committee are retired.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I put that out there for a number of reasons. One is that I know so many people, as they approach retirement age, they question how they can still be purposeful in their lives.
Beautiful.
Well,
right.
There you go. That's
yeah.
getting involved with some kind of a grassroots committee
yeah.
For creating more sustainable living. That's a fabulous opportunity.
Yeah.
And even
yeah.
for folks
it really
who aren't
is. I mean,
of retirement
yeah.
age. Yeah,
we have a lot of 70 and 80 year olds in our group, as
mm-hmm.
well as 50 year old people who are still working, you know, but most of us, you know, are older, and
mm-hmm.
yet we're not done. We're not done yet.
Of course.
You know?
Of
yeah.
course.
Yeah.
And regardless of one's age, I think one of the most frequent questions that I hear from clients, regardless of their age, what is my life purpose? How can I have an impact on the world? How can I
Absolutely.
Make a difference?
Yeah, what is
and
life
I think this
for,
is a great
yeah.
example. You know, get involved with your community. Look at create it, whether it's for something like creating sustainable living, and more eco-friendly practices or something else within your community, but get involved.
I do have
a question about that. Rewinding 11 years or so, you said in 2005 when a group of concerned citizens came together, how did you find each other? Like what was the first step in terms of people making contact with others and getting that somehow into an initial community group?
Well, a couple of things happened. A friend of mine, we're taking a walk one day, and we were talking about the post-carbon era. What would that look like? And what could we do? And I suggested, well, maybe we could both buy a Prius. We both had gas-guzzling cars at the time. And we could share it, and we could take turns with it, you know. And she said, well, that's an interesting idea. Well, I bet there would be other people who would be interested in coming up with ideas that we could do. So we called our local friends who lived within walking distance of either of our houses and called for a potluck dinner one night. So we did that, and we became what we now know in town as the neighborhood group, although not everybody lives within walking distance. We had 35 people show up that first night. And 35 households. And in the discussions that followed, you know, we made up lists at first of what do we each have? You know, well, Joe has a lawnmower. Well, so-and-so has a sewing machine. And somebody else knows how to, construct stuff. And somebody else has child, you know, babysitting skills. And, other, you know, so we just put down everything that we, all the assets that we had in the group in terms of skills. And then, and skills or things, you know, appliances or whatever, whatever that could be shared, anything that we would be willing to share. And then we also made a list of every of all of the backgrounds that we had. We actually ended up telling each other our life stories, but you know, we started finding out more about our backgrounds and our spiritual journeys as well, because we feel and we felt that taking care of the planet is a spiritual commitment and as well as a physical commitment. So so out of that, a few of the people said, you know, we really need to work with the town on this. We can't just have this be our private lives. You know, we have to, if we're going to really make a difference, we've got to go beyond just our own household. So I got involved in that group, and that was around 2005 to 7. 2007. Mm-hmm. So in those 2 years, we sort of, you know, it wasn't really formalized until 2007, but it was, you know, that was part of the process. We were just friends and neighbors, and, you know, we could borrow sugar from each other, but could we borrow a lawnmower or a snowblower? That was a little bit different, you know, and because I know I was walking down the street one winter day, and every single house was out snowblowing their driveway. And I thought, that doesn't make sense. Why aren't we using one snowblower and sharing with each other? So it was that kind of thing, you know, creating much more of a community, neighborhood kind of community. And actually, we did another whole project with the landlords in town, because we have a lot of rental units. So we got a bunch of kids from the local community college who paid a small stipend to, and they went door to door for 3 months. Leaving off flyers and interviewing people and seeing whether they would be willing to, you know, influence their landlords to make the changes, because it's difficult for landlords if they don't have incentive to pay for the changes in their buildings that are needed. You know, they need to have some kind of a reward system. And so, you know, we got them to sort of say, listen, part of the reason that we're living in this house is that you're greener than some other properties. But we also have been very active in working with the legislature in Boston. And we have two people, in fact, in our little group. But they go into Boston. They know who all the representatives and senators are. They know who's in charge of what committee and what bill is up. And it's so they'll create phone campaigns, letter-writing campaigns on a particular bill. And, you know, this is it's just amazing what they'll do. That's the level at which they like to work. They don't even like to work within the town. They want to work within the state, you know. So there's a place for everybody. That's what I want to say, that there's something that everybody can do, no matter how big or how little. And it just depends on what's your passion, what do you care about in terms of the climate and the future of your children. I mean, we're all grandparents, so we're very concerned about the future for our grandchildren. Very concerned.
Right, you're passing on the earth, and you wanted the proverb. The proverb, is it Native American or is it African? The earth does not belong to you. The earth was not given to you by your parents. It was loaned to you by your children, which is something that I've always loved.
I love that.
I think the example that you gave about sharing commodities.
Uh-huh.
Is really interesting. You know, the point being that I took from that is that if every household is purchasing the snowblower or the lawnmower,
mm-hmm.
what that
mm-hmm.
leads to is more consumption. It's what is the lawnmower, the snow? It's made of plastic.
That's
it's made
right.
of metals. It's made, you know,
that's
all
right.
kinds of things. It's produced in
it
a
uses
factory.
Gasoline. It's gasoline, right.
It's shipped probably across mm-hmm. the Pacific Ocean from China, which is, you know, people are following the air pollution is horrendous. People can't even breathe.
I know.
In Beijing right now, they can't go out outside because it's gotten so
mm-hmm.
bad. So just reducing consumption of commodities by sharing certain commodities that we don't need to use every single day. You know, obviously, you know, your coffee maker or your toaster, you have things that you use every single day that are part of
mm-hmm.
the livelihood for your family, that's different. But a snowblower that you use, I don't know, 10 times throughout the winter, 15 times. Well, it's New England, so it happens. But you use it, what, for half an hour, maybe an hour, and then a neighbor can use it. I think that's a great example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think it's also a way that people can live on a budget. I mean, I'm thinking about, gosh, there are certain things if I could share with neighbors. Well, gee, if you buy this, I'll buy that. And it's kind of a communal experience that reduces financial costs as well, which of course I think we'd all appreciate.
Well, and you have a particular different climate there, but you also have a wonderful nationally known bike program where you can pick up a bike somewhere and then leave it somewhere else, and it's all part. Do you have that in San Francisco?
There's they've just fairly recently initiated that in San Francisco. Los Angeles, I think, has had it for a little longer. So we have that. We've also got, I mean, San Francisco was really big in the beginning with city car share and Zipcar and those kinds of things too.
You know,
which they sprouted up areas where you could park the car, pick up a car, rent it for a few hours. They're all small cars that are easy to maneuver in a city. Gas is covered. Insurance is covered. You could rent it just for a couple of hours.
Mm-hmm.
They've
mm-hmm.
got parking spaces spread out in every neighborhood in the city, so you don't have to worry about that. And you can use a car if you need to without having to worry about keeping a car in the city, which is costly and can be a bit of a hassle. So there's that. California also has been very vigilant about solar power. Of course, we can be because we have more sunshine than some other states. But there are major tax incentives for people who install solar power. There have been also incentives, well, of course, because of the drought, there have been incentives around water reduction. I know Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, are statewide gas and electric company. They have had all kinds of incentives for people who install better installation or more efficient water heaters and appliances and that sort of thing. So they're actually – we do have a lot of programs where the state will assist in some of the financials. You know, sometimes, of course, there does still need to be an investment. But I know a number of people who have installed solar panels and on their homes, and between the tax credit that they get for doing that and the long-term costs in terms of what it will save them on their gas and electric bills, it actually pays for itself fairly quickly. I think there have been
studies done
on that.
So you're doing, I mean, you've got a lot of stuff that people could join
But
I think finding out, researching it, taking the time to just find out what's going on that could impact my life differently and the life of my kids and my family and, you know, whatever. You know, I mean, everything. We even have a woman in our community who's not, her program is separate from Green and Greenfield, but we have featured her at some of our workshops, and she is into green burials. which is,
wow,
what do you do with your body after you die? What do you want to do? What are the options?
What does a green burial consist of?
Well, it consists of not embalming. It involves,
mm-hmm,
finding a piece of land and actually buying a piece of land, getting a group of people to buy a piece of land that they will then bury a body as is,
mm-hmm,
instead,
mm-hmm,
of having to go through the funeral industry,
mm-hmm,
which is very toxic.
Mm-hmm.
Embalming, yeah, it's very toxic stuff that goes back into the earth. And then, you know, there are different crematoriums actually that are very sustainable and using electricity in very sustainable ways. So, you know, even just little, I mean, it seems like who wants to pay attention to that really before your time, but that's something that Massachusetts is actually on the brink of being able to. I think we've got 3 or 4 green cemeteries now, so,
uh-huh,
that, but you know, it's all the rules and regs about who gets to be there. And you know, what people used to do is they'd have a family burial lot in the backyard kind of thing, but
yeah,
back 40. But where we have these congested cities, we can't do that. So what else can we do, you know? And so, yeah, there's a movement afoot around that. And
right. We're getting short on time. We need to wrap it up in a moment or two. But what a great note to end on. I mean, that we can, in fact, engage
even
in more sustainable living practices even through our death as our final wish.
Exactly. Yep.
you know, to add a little bit of humor to it, but it's in all seriousness, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah,
so, gosh, you've covered from something that was on very grassroots level, just among neighbors, involving 1,800 homes, 59 businesses, banks offering 0% interest loans for people who needed to make upgrades on their homes, involving local government, using, getting involved with people who could make a video of curriculum for kids, for adults, airing it repeatedly on local TV stations, doing trainings in churches and synagogues, incorporating it as a moral and a spiritual issue, getting involved in the public schools, getting involved with science and spirituality expos and games for the public schools, and grant writing both on state and federal levels. And you've also talked about, you know, initiating it as a 10% challenge. Let's just,
mm-hmm,
start with that. And people can reduce by 10%. I've seen that even in California this past year, where there have been initiatives and people have stepped up to the challenge to reduce their water consumption by 10% or 20%. It can be done. Reducing energy by 10 or 20% is not that big a deal.
No, it isn't. It isn't.
It's just with certain small choices, things that we might take for granted. The earth is not something that we can take for granted. It's something that we really need to care for. And I agree, it is a spiritual issue.
Yeah.
We are out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time today to share your insight, to share your story. I'm really hoping that it'll inspire other people to mobilize within their own communities. Because let's face it, folks, the federal government is not going to solve it all for us. We need to get involved in our communities on a grassroots level to create positive change. Once again, I've been chatting with Rebecca King. She is heavily involved with a project in a small town in western Massachusetts called Greening Greenfield. You can find out more about Greening Greenfield at their website, greeninggreenfield.org. Rebecca, thank you so very much once again, and I'm sending you lots of love and lots of light.
Thank you so much, Matt. Talk again soon, I hope.
Thank you so much for tuning in to Intuitive Transformation Radio with Matthew Engel and Joy Barker. Once again, the Introductory Psychic Skills class for Daily Living on June 19th is sold out. However, if you'd like to be placed on a wait list or get some information about the next class, please send me a private message. I do still have a little bit of space left in the Level 2 class on July 17th. That class covers the astral body, chakras, energy boundaries, energy clearing, an introduction to meeting a spirit guide, getting yes-no, authentic versus inauthentic, answers about authenticity versus inauthenticity in terms of answers for yourself when you're trying to get clarity on a question psychically, and so much more. And as always, you can sign up for my newsletter at matthewengel.com. You'll get a coupon for 20% off your first intuitive reading, which can, of course, be done in person or by phone. You can also get monthly articles that I write about personal and spiritual growth, abundance in business, and so much more. Joy and I will be back in 2 weeks on June 15th doing a show entitled The Empath's Survivor Guide. So that's a great show with a toolkit for surviving if you are a sensitive, empathic person. And we will then be off for a few weeks as I'll be going on vacation at the end of June, beginning of July. And, of course, we'll be back later in July with some other wonderful shows. Thank you again so much for tuning in. And as always, work with your intuition. It's one of the most powerful tools that you have.
Thanks for listening to Intuitive Transformation Radio with Matthew Engel and Joy Barker. For additional information about this program, to sign up for my free newsletter, or to book a private session, please visit intuitivetransformationradio.com or matthewengel.com. That's Matthew with two T's, E-N-G-E-L. Joy can be reached at angeltalkcafe.com. Until next time, fill your day with love and light.